I really am relying on your wisdom, and this seminar is designed to draw it out of you in four specific places, but there may be other times where it's useful also, so we don't necessarily have to wait for the formal places where it's designed. The movie Chariots of Fire came out when Nazarenes couldn't go to movies, so I assume no one has seen it. But if you have, the movie about that Scottish runner just really resonates with me in a lot of ways. And there's a line in that movie, and we're kind of movie line people. We have one of those weird movie line marriages where we're always quoting movie lines back and forth, like good Nazarenes do.
You had me at hello.
For example. There's a line in Chariots of Fire where Eric Liddell, who is a runner, a competitive runner, says, "When I run, I feel God's pleasure." And I love that line. It's like, this is what God made me to do. When I'm doing this, I feel God's pleasure. That line captivated me. It wasn't in a sermon, it was in a movie, but it just captured me. We were up in Minnesota at a resort as the window dressing at a ministers and mates retreat where Dr. Paul Cunningham and his wife were the deal. They were the main feature, and then off on the side there was whoever we are. So every evening we had Dr. Cunningham preaching these marvelous sermons. If I could think the way he preaches, let alone preach the way he preaches. Oh my goodness. He was the richness and then we were the fluff. And we were speaking to pastors and their mates about marriage and family and child raising and the fishbowl of the parsonage. When we weren't speaking, we were counseling. So we had the real meat, which was Paul Cunningham, and then around the edges we were teaching a little bit and counseling a little bit. We left that week feeling like Eric Liddell. It's like, when we do this, we feel God's pleasure. This is what God made us to do. So for 31 years now, that's what God has been having us do with pastors, with missionaries. We go wherever the Nazarene Church sends us. They're not real crazy about bringing us back, but they love to send us. They love to send. We've been to 42 countries, which it feels like a lot if you're us. That's a lot of laundry. But I think 42 countries is like less than one-fourth of how many there are. And I think the church is in, aren't we in over 100?
Yes, 160.
See, I knew he would know. There you are. So we have been sent to be with pastors and missionaries. We're always the window dressing. We're not the meat. You have Jerry Porter or you have Carla Sunberger. You have someone who's there to bring the message. And we're just there to do a little teaching and counseling on the side. One of my favorite glimpses of that, the first time we went to Southeastern Europe, with people from Turkey and Kosovo and Romania and Bulgaria and all these places, the retreat organizer stood up at the start of the retreat and said, "Now, the Frisbees are teaching, and there's a sign-up sheet for counseling, but just in case those sign-up sheets fill up, I want you to know, I personally know David and Lisa, they would want to talk to you no matter what time of day, no matter what was going on." The speaker, to open the retreat, said, "I want you to feel free during the meal times to just sit down and get a counseling session, or at the end of the night, just sit down." We obviously couldn't take that back or act like it was different than that. So, we didn't sleep. But that is where we feel God's pleasure. We love to work with pastors and their families or with missionaries and their families. That's just what energizes us. So, in 2011 at M11, downstairs in the basement, minding our own business, some guy says, "Hey, buddy." And we get called over because the Nazarene Church wants to do some projects to help pastors. They want to do a project to help pastors deal with stress. And they want to do a project to help churches not make pastors have so much stress to deal with. So they want to do two projects. 4 years of fun research later, that first project is called Managing Stress in Ministry, and that's a pastor's project, training pastors how to cope with stress, coping mechanisms. The second project, and by the way, titles are always the publisher. We have nothing to do with that. You know, our books are always called, like, Why Holiness Matters Today or something. We always write holiness into the title because, you know, we'd like to get published. Then it goes to the publisher, and it comes, you never know. We just write books. We don't write titles. So the title of this project is When Bad Churches Happen to Good Pastors. And that book has a track for pastors, a track for churches and church boards, and a track for district superintendents on the theory that DSs read. Now, well, this is an untested premise. It's an untested premise. Let them have time to see if it happens or not. The second premise would be they learn. DSs learn.
They're waiting for the movie.
There you go. All right. So, I just want to abandon any premise of objectivity, because after 31 years or so of doing this, I don't have objectivity. I am not a friend of objectivity. I just flat love pastors and their families. And if we can help pastors or missionaries, anybody that's in frontline ministry, if we can be helpful, that's what we do. And they keep finding someplace else to send us, and then reluctantly they bring us back. So that's our life in a nutshell. Let's talk about God's call on our lives as we open the conversation. This is we shepherds. When God calls us into pastoral ministry, he usually doesn't wait until we are highly advanced spiritually, or we are fully mature emotionally, or we are astute and savvy administrators of church business, or we're politically astute. My observation for your consideration would be that God tends to call works in progress. Do you find it so? It would be cool if we were all finished work when we graduated from Nazarene Bible College or NTS or whatever, or the course of study, if once they handed us the diploma, we were finished work. Or it would be cool if, like, ordination bestowed finishing upon us. Wouldn't that be cool if part of the work of the Holy Spirit was just like, psh, and I'm now, like, emotionally mature and spiritually mature and the fountain of all wisdom, and I'm not. Those of us who serve in ministry are unfinished and incomplete. We are finding our way forward while we are serving and leading others. We're busy growing up as we are busy growing others up. Anyone want to object to that and say, enough autobiography, talk about me? We're trying to grow up our sanity. It's much like parenting. Believe it or not, you're raising, did you ever notice you're raising kids and you don't have life figured out? What was God thinking? I have no idea. And it's much like that. God asks you to be a pastor, and you don't necessarily have life figured out. One observer has said it this way. This is so well, I wish I'd said this. The terrain of pastoral ministry seems to consist of hills to climb, valleys to survive, and trails to blaze on your own. Here's the meat of it. I'm glad there's a God, but I often wish he would have called someone else, not me. Isn't that interesting? It's a character building exercise. When God calls us to ministry, it's a character building exercise for us. We're chosen, we're called. We're also unfinished. So we're growing up while leading others. We're works in progress. I don't know about you, I do some preaching. You probably do a lot more than I do. I feel very visible when I preach, very revealed when I preach. Like there's nothing to hide behind. Like I'm just out there. Maybe you don't. Maybe you've mastered the art of preaching while keeping up a shield of some kind. Teach me that, because I really feel very visible, very exposed in a way when I preach. Like it's just all out there. Our unfinished business is visible and on display, and yet here we are leading. That's mysterious, at least to me. Wouldn't you think God would wait and call perfect people or all-knowing people or all-wise people? I don't know. Meanwhile, about those we lead, you remember them, the sheep, the flock? By the way, if you don't have a sermon ready for Sunday, I've got material for you right here. While God calls us to be his shepherds, he also calls our flocks to honor our leadership in their lives. By the way, I'm not making this up. Respect our service to God's kingdom, submit to our God-granted authority, desire to make our ministry less stressful, dwell at peace among themselves. Do these sound like good ideas? Because they come right out of some book I read. Here's your text for Sunday, Hebrews 13:17. You don't need to go farther. Shall we read it together? Have confidence in your leaders and submit to their authority, because they keep watch over you as those who must give an account of their service. Do this so that their work will be a joy, not a burden, for that would be of no benefit to you. If you can teach that to your church, what else do you have to tell them? And it's not even our idea. It's God's idea. Wow. But in case you think I'm proof texting, here's one. Let's read this one together. And we urge you, our brothers, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord, and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. Doesn't that describe most church board meetings you've been to? Isn't that sort of a picture of church boards in action right there? Because if it's not, it should be according to that book, not this, forget this book, that book. And then, of course, there's your favorite and mine. That inspiring passage in 1 Timothy, do you have this one memorized? 5:17, about being worthy of a double stipend. I know there's theological disagreement on whether that's a double paycheck, but it is a double paycheck. It is. So that's what you're due. So God's instructions for the sheep, the flock, are clear but are not always clearly followed. Too often a pastor is disrespected or mistreated in the setting of her ministry. My brothers and my sisters, it should not be this way, but too often it is. We are losing 1,700 pastors a month, a figure I did not believe when I heard it. Not we, the Nazarenes. We could only do that about 6 months. We'd be done. We could only do that half a year. We'd be done. We, the Evangelical Church in North America, are losing 1,700 pastors a month, some of whom are aging out, but many of whom are not aging out. They're burning out. They're stressing out. They're failing out. It's going like that. One experienced pastor has said this: while I struggle to respect myself daily, I just wish my parishioners would make the same effort and try to respect me also. It's a character building exercise, not just for us, but for the flock. They're asked to honor, respect, serve, submit to pastoral leaders, even when, and I would say especially when, those leaders are themselves works in progress by God. That's how you learn respect. It's easy to respect someone you agree with, that you naturally follow anyway. To respect a leader that you're out of sync with, or a leader that's unfinished, that's how you learn what godly respect is like. So, the biblical parameters for ministry are challenging. Challenges for the shepherds. Challenges for the sheep. Get your answers ready. We're going to solve problems. There's a lot of growth needed for those in each of the roles, shepherds and sheep. Neither situation is simple. Neither situation is easy. If you can think back to before you ever were a pastor, you can probably think of pastors that you respected more and pastors that you respected less. Am I wrong? And if that's true for you as an ordained elder, sanctified holy and entirely and perfect, it might be true for other people as well. Some, it's just easier to respect some people than others. So if you're a pastor, getting through all this, safely passing through the varied terrain of pastoral ministry, is just a complex navigational challenge. That's just getting through. Thriving in pastoral ministry can at times appear to be an unrealistic expectation. What can we reasonably hope for? How can we move in the direction of health and wholeness in ministry under current operational conditions? Operational conditions under which 1,700 pastors every month say, not me, not anymore, done, out, gone. Under these conditions, how can we get healthy? What can we do? This project, Managing Stress, looked at 5 key stressors that apply to settings of pastoral service. I'm assuming you can understand financial scarcity. Can I get a witness? I'm assuming that situational adversity, which basically just means conflict in the church, is also understandable. Yes? I'm assuming that bivocational complexity applies to what, 80% of the pastors? How many pastors on your district are bivocational in your opinion, or maybe you know the actual answer? 50%? 70%? So half. And here's how I might say that with my heart for pastors. Half of the pastors serving in your district are not being paid enough by their church to live on. So they must do something else to provide for their family. Is that an ungracious way of saying that?
The flip side of that would be either they or their wife has to work for them to make a living.
Yes, or their husband.
A bivocational, but
Right, the spouse has to work. Right. So we'll look at just the top two for right now, because I think you can figure out financial scarcity on your own. We'll look at just the top two, and here's where your answers are going to come in handy. Get ready to answer. Answer mode. Here's the issue. Is the pastor the true leader of her congregation, or is she only an employee who serves at the whim of her employer? Role ambiguity. Is she the leader, or is she an employee? Get ready with your answers. Does she serve at will, and thus she is subject to the capricious whims of her employers, aka the flock, the sheep? Or is she a shepherd who is given authority and leadership over the flock? Employee? Leader? Authority? Underling? Let's figure this out. Here's a verbatim from the project as we did it. This is a verbatim. A board member during a transition time after the founding pastor departed. We own the ranch now. We are going to find ourselves a new ranch hand around here. I wish I was making this up. I wish I was clever enough to come up with that. Who's we? We the board, we the church. What do? We own a ranch. What are we going to do? We're going to find a ranch hand. We the owners are going to find a ranch hand. Here comes the classified ad, ranch hand wanted. Would you like to send your resume? Here's another one. Member of a church board after an older pastor retired from ministry. Not making this up. The horse is gone now. We are going to look for a colt that we can train up for ourselves. I wish I was making this up. Here it is, answered people. Is the pastor the leader of her congregation, or is she just an employee who serves at the whim of her employer? The way we answer that question doesn't change anything. It changes everything. Solve it, we'll go home, forget the other questions. Is the pastor the leader, the follower, the authority, the underling? Grab your manuals, it's on page what?
12.
Thank you, William.
He's not the employee. They don't have that kind of money. Nobody has that kind of money.
All right. So your premise would be pastor is leader. Is that your premise? Are you going to try to defend that?
He's chairman of the board. He's the leader of the church, and his primary function is to be a servant.
But is he viewed
not
as
employee?
The leader or the servant leader?
Servant leader.
So he or she is both.
But that doesn't drop the word leader.
Yes, Karen.
I served as an associate pastor for over 20 years in a large church, and I'll tell you that the role of an associate, a full-time associate, is we are the hired help, period. Because we are not the senior pastor, but we are pastor. We are, I've been called things worse than a horse.
Wow.
Just saying, as associates in
some churches, even the pastor is hired help.
Treated as the hired help.
Yeah.
And we don't have any authority. We are there to work.
So it is ranch hand.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the owners of the ranch got some ranch hands. And it should be their prerogative to tell ranch hands what to do. That's what ranch owners do, right? Just tell ranch hands what's wrong with that picture? That's what ranch hands do.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I know there's wisdom. Yes?
The problem is the church doesn't know what to do. I mean, like, if I ask my church, you know, tell me what to do, like, they'd be like, I don't know. You know what I mean? So I mean, there has to be some sort of a leadership. There has to be some sort of unless God is going to come in like a congregational sense, where the congregational church, they share that leadership among themselves, but for the Quakers, yeah. But yeah, I mean, within our context, that there has to be a leadership area. I mean, my church doesn't know what to do.
That's why you're there.
And neither do I. That's
We talked about that. We talked about that. Slide 3, we talked about that. How should it be? Should the pastor be the leader of her flock, or should she be at their beck and call because they own the ranch? How should it be?
There was nothing in the scriptures that you read that indicated that the pastor was an employee.
Yes. Dangerous to bring that up. Real dangerous. There's nothing in the scripture about focus groups and surveys and what kind of strengths we want in our next pastor, or a whole lot of things we actually do that I'm not saying are bad, especially not on tape. I'm not saying, yes, we're on tape. I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying we cannot draw out from scripture something that empowers a congregation to like rate the pastor or grade the pastor or judge the pastor or review the pastor. I'm not saying it's wrong to do it, because I like my job, whatever my job is, I'd like to keep doing it. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying I can't scripturally dig out the underpinnings for that. Like all this stuff, what I can dig out is how we're supposed to respect, honor, submit, make their job a joy. That's right there in the Bible. Yes, ma'am.
They've got a way of finagling it, though, so you make you think you're the leader.
Explain that.
Well, you know, you come in and they, you're over this and this and this, but all the time they've got their little clique that gets together behind you, and then, you know, they're the ones trying to handle it even though you're supposed to be the leader.
Aha. So the real power is elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You have these little things you do, but the real power is underneath here. Can I get a witness? Yeah. Yes, John.
Do you not think that in some ways you create the situation in which you work in? If you act like an employee, you're treated like an employee. If you act like a leader, you're treated like a leader. I know that when I first went to the church I'm at, which I've been at a long time, I made some suggestions and ran into some really strong opposition, which I dealt with in a redeeming as possible way.
God bless you.
After I'd been there a period of time, 7 or 8 years, I suggested making some changes to the sanctuary. And when we were done, one of the ladies, who we call Sarge, who sort of runs things, came into the sanctuary and she got tears in her eyes and she looked at me, and this is, I'll never forget this. She looked at me and said, Pastor John, I want you to know that when you suggested this, I thought you were crazy. But because all the other things that you talked, that you had us do worked, I went along with it and I'm glad I did. So I think if you act like an employee, you're going to be treated like an employee. If you act like a leader, you're either going to become a leader or you're going to leave, one or the other. But it really comes down to how we do it. Or I could be wrong. What do I know?
I like that thought. I think that some people would speak into that they were never given a chance to lead and that leadership wasn't even on the table for them. Both women and men would say, I wasn't given the option to lead or the choice of leading. That I didn't have that permission. That wasn't on the table as an option, some might say. But I like what you're saying. And I think you're right. You would either lead or leave. I think that's probably what you... Yes. And both of those are good options, probably.
You can't detect that when you're meeting with the board ahead of time?
Wouldn't you think so? Wouldn't you think so? But no. No.
I think we have to, for us in this room and in this gathering, keep in context who we are.
Yes.
And even what our structural context
yes.
is as
yes.
the Church of the
right.
Nazarene.
Right.
So, it's not an autonomous, independent
right.
Community church.
Right. Right.
There are legal obligations and responsibilities. And in our structure, not necessarily biblical, but it's one that has developed over time
right.
as we think effective.
Right.
We have a superintendency. And I think it's the responsibility of a district superintendent as he deals with church leadership to remind them that they're not CEOs. That they're not boards of trustees. They're more Aaron and Hur, whose principal task is to hold up the arms of their Moses.
Sweet.
I think that's an important, now does it always take? I don't
yes.
think it does.
Yes.
Because sometimes there are entrenched power groups
right.
within
right.
a local church.
Right.
And one of the consequences of that happening is that there could be a church that falls into crisis or great conflict. And then you have other issues
right.
To deal with that
right.
just add to one's strife
right.
and stress.
Right.
But I think we have the potential, if a district superintendent does what he or she should be doing, is that in the interim, as they're looking for a pastor, to recognize that there are right understandings. And yes, a district superintendent might try to get what do you have? What is your sense of the needs
right.
of this church?
Right.
What kind of not necessarily a profile, but what kind of characteristics do you think would be effective? And then district superintendent sifts that with what he
right.
or she believes,
right.
and works with the church to find a pastor. And then also we've got to have a pastor then willing to stand up.
Yes.
And,
yes.
and recognize his or her role and responsibility as the leader of the church. Hmm. And hopefully the DS would always stand behind the pastor when they do.
So what John is proposing is that a district superintendent in our structure would help a church understand that this is not okay.
Right
here. That's not okay. And
we wouldn't know that
that's not okay.
Unless we just happen to be there.
Yes. True. True.
Just piggybacking on why he says I'm not the DS, but I work with the DS. And he's trying to change the culture of the language. We don't hire, we call the pastor.
I like that.
You know,
I like that.
Because they want to say hire.
Yes.
All the time.
Yes.
Like
yes.
We don't hire a pastor.
Yes.
We are called.
Yes.
Right.
See?
Feel free to use my line. You don't have that kind of money.
But that mindset is answering this question, and it's helping the flock understand that they're the flock, not the shepherd. Can you hear? Does it sound like I'm a little biased? Because I'm not. I'm very biased. I'm not a little biased. You're just usually going to be okay respecting a shepherd. Are there going to be bad apple shepherds? Of course there are.
Yes, there
you
are.
You may have to get out of a church and go somewhere where you can respect the shepherd, but I think there's gracious ways to do that. Most of the time, I think respecting the shepherd is going to be a good way forward for most people to grow up. I really do. I really do. Any other thoughts on this? John had a great answer. Any other thoughts? Did we solve the problem? Is the pastor the leader or an employee? Which is she? Okay.
In both settings.
Okay.
In our denomination, they're the leader.
Yes. Ex officio, on paper. That's what the documents say. Yes.
Think about the powers that attend to the pastor. I mean, you appoint all non-standing committees.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You have authority on the nominating committee.
Yes. Yes.
There's a lot. You set the agenda for the board meeting.
Yes.
All the board members are supposed to be talking to you
yes.
as a chairman.
Yes. So you're defending...
A lot of things where you do have power if you, you know...
You're defending positional and structural authority
yeah.
in a world that increasingly is built on relational authority. I'm not arguing with you. It's just
that.
We're in a world where relational authority...
Relational authority doesn't come to you the day you take over
very
the
true. Very true.
Very true. Years to build up and then people begin to get confidence in you and begin
yes.
to say, yeah, you know...
Yes.
But... When you come into a church and they have an attitude like that, I took over a church like that. They were split right down the middle. They just, the only thing that was nice about that church is they were too hard-headed to leave. They just stayed there and hated each other.
We load.
They had three aisles in the church and they wouldn't use the center aisle for fear of bumping into each other. You know, it was a strange congregation. But,
Wow. We've got wisdom in the back. Go ahead, sir.
My first church, I was 23. My first board meeting, the eldest member was 83. But she treated me like I was the seasoned pastor.
God bless her.
And that made a tremendous
yes.
difference from the beginning.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Because yeah. there were a few that felt that I was hired.
Yes, we're going to train up that colt. Yeah.
Too young to know what he was doing.
That's right.
And I was too young to know what I was doing, but that's beside the point.
Can we change gears or you want to stay on that one? I'm not tired of that problem. Can we change gears or you want to stay right there? Okay, here's a second one to solve since we're in solve mode. Performance anxiety is another thing managing stress looks at. The issue here is what happens if the visible markers of success are not present in your ministry? By visible markers, I'm talking about all that stuff at assembly, all those metrics of attendance and worship and conversions and new Nazarenes and baptisms and etc. If those markers don't line up in a way that looks successful, how does that impact the self-esteem of the pastor? I will never forget this verbatim as long as I live, and I wish you could hear it like I heard it from the person. Third church, it's a he pastor, it's a male. He's serving his third church. Things were bad when I got here, but I am gradually making them worse. I wish you could hear it from him. By that, as we unpacked that, what he meant was his first two churches hadn't gone anywhere numerically other than kind of down a little bit, and now his third church was starting to show the same pattern, not going anywhere numerically other than down a little bit. He didn't have any other way to measure himself than that. Those metrics, those visible markers. Things were bad when I got here, but I. He's taking authority. He's taking responsibility. He's saying he's the problem. Was the church going up when he got there? I don't think so. But suddenly it's become his problem. Or this one, another very similar situation. Third church. I don't know what it is with a third church. If you're on your second church, stay there. Whatever it is with a third church, this is a third church comment also. I thought I had some skills, meaning skills for ministry. I thought I had some, but I'm beginning to think that I might actually be the problem around here. A thought that is forming because the metrics don't look shiny, because the metrics aren't all embroidered with guilt, because this year I didn't get the Sunday School Growth Award. How do we work around that? When we succeed, we tend to give God the credit. I listen to pastors. I love pastors. Pastors, when a church is going up, most pastors don't stand up and say, well, I've built this church from... Pastors are gracious. They're giving God the credit. They're saying, God has done this. Pastors will often say, I just try to stay out of God's way. They are so gracious. But when the church is going downhill, all of a sudden that's on me. All of a sudden I'm the problem. What can we do about this? How can we help pastors unhitch their self-esteem from these crazy metrics? Yes?
You are called to the church. God called you. God will let you know when it's time to leave. Until then, be the pastor he called you to be for that church.
But I feel like a failure. My membership rose from 97 to 86. And now I'm going to assembly. And everybody else's church went up, but not mine.
Mother Teresa said, God did not call me to be successful. He called me to be faithful.
Boom.
And I remind myself of that as I'm preparing my year-end report in this next week and recognize that the church has not grown in the speed and the expectation that I honestly just dreamed that it was going to happen.
Right.
And
right.
3 years in, we're still just plugging along at this tiny little increase. And I'm thankful for the increase.
Yes.
But when you start on your first Sunday with only 18 folks there, it doesn't take much to grow. How to redefine success.
Yes.
Because success isn't the only thing our church measures is the metrics. How many did you take in new membership?
Right.
How many? What was the regular attendance?
Right.
How many did you baptize? All of that. They, for whatever reasons, they feel the need to count those numbers, and we have to document that.
Yeah.
But that is not the sign of the life and health of the church.
Yeah.
It really isn't.
Yeah.
And so I tell myself that regularly.
Yeah. Somehow when the metrics are bad, I take that on myself. This is why pastors leave the ministry all the time, because they couldn't succeed, because they didn't succeed. Yes, John.
I was just going to say, there are three thoughts that I have on this, and I'm in the same district she is, and I think she's a great pastor. We have to remember that healthy growth, in spite of what we see from some stories, is not this kind of growth, because this kind of growth tends to drop off that way too. Healthy growth, missiologically, is growth like exactly what's happening in Karen's church, is that it takes sometimes years of incremental until the foundation is so solid with a strong pastor's leadership, and then you'll see a more dramatic growth. I think that's one thing to learn. I think another thing we need to remember about the declining church, in my opinion, is that churches have life cycles. Before I came to the district where I am, there was a church that had been closed in the community. It had been a church that had been there from almost the beginning of our district, and it was closed because it was declining and just no hope. But the town did too. They closed the town.
But it was the pastor's fault, John. It was the pastor's fault.
And so that comes into play sometimes. There is normal life cycle. Now, the difference between us and a church is that a church on its declining years, it can have renewal. And we can have, I'd like to see old churches with a new start mentality born.
Right, right.
But then the third thing is too, and this is a hard thing, is we also have pastors who love God so much and have somehow gotten in their mind, if I'm to be a faithful follower of God, I probably need to be a pastor. And maybe what they needed to be was a really good board member or a faithful Sunday school teacher, because they didn't have the gifts and skills. My father was a medical missionary and returned to Chicago when I was 3 years old. And he had a wonderful medical practice. Great man. He was a theologian par excellence. His theological library is larger than his medical library. A famous old-time Nazarene theologian, educator, R.B. DeLonco. My dad, the greatest layman theologian he'd ever known. And he was on the advisory board, the general board, and all these kinds of things. But if my dad had been a pastor, it would have been a disaster. It would have been just awful. I mean, I sat at the dining room devotions every night and, as his son had trouble keeping the way. And I mean, he just would have been a lousy pastor. Now, when he was younger, he got a lot of folks who recognized his gifts and skills. And said,
right.
You need to be a pastor. And when he did move in that direction, his spiritual life waned, frankly, until he went back into his pursuit of being a doctor, then he blossomed. And so I think sometimes there might be those who, wanting to be all that God wants them to be, maybe aren't in the place that God wants them to be, and there are frustrations, and maybe sometimes those are even markers. But it's hard for, I think, district superintendents or credentials boards too often to say, we don't see
the gifts and graces. I like that thought. I would hope in that case somebody kind of gets called out rather than burning out or stressing out or failing out. And I don't mean failing, but they often say failing out. I failed. I tried that. I failed. How do we unhook them from the self-esteem issues that are clustered around the church not growing? How do you get a pastor off that hook? If you want a pastor, maybe you want a pastor to be on that hook. I don't know. Yes.
Whose voice are they listening to? Because when I heard you trying to get us to respond, you were saying, I feel like a failure. I don't have a
yes.
haven't got them.
Yes.
So we're either listening to our own voice,
the voice
of our peers or our congregation,
yes,
instead of the voice of the face that we're looking right into.
Beautiful.
Jesus Christ.
Yes.
He is saying, yes, you're struggling, and yes, you need to move on or consider something else, then yes. But if we're looking in, if we're hearing his voice clearly, and we're being faithful, I'm sure that's not what we're going to do.
Got it. So paradigm shift, which is what Karen was saying also. Paradigm shift. Quit listening to this inner angst and get in Jesus' face. I'm paraphrasing, but get in Jesus' face. Isn't that what you said, more or less? How do you improve on that? That's good advice. The other project, when bad churches happen to good pastors, not that that ever happens, but just theoretically, contents like from Genesis to Exodus, after bright beginnings, why do so many leave the ministry? $1,700 a month. Missing the promised land, the consequences and outcomes of short-term pastoral service. Almost everyone who looks at this says between year 5 and year 7 is when you start to be effective. And your really effective years are like 12 to 15. Some of them go on to say leave after 20. That part I'm not necessarily with them on. But they do say you've got to stay 5 to 7 to see anything. Longer is better. Pain, regret, damage control after ministry ends. And these are some we'll talk about. Dynasty, when one family controls the church. Dukes of Hazzard, dealing with a self-appointed church boss. MASH, when pastors are among the wounded. There's some fun topics in there. Here's the dynasty issue. How do you respond when one family rules almost every aspect of your church life? How do you rein in those who are reigning? We talk about an Olive Garden church. If you're here, you must be family. Four generations of the family run the church. They've got the treasurer. They've got more than half the church board. Nothing happens in that church that doesn't run through the family. The family decides. Forget the pastor. They got the church board in their pocket anyway.
You can grow your way out of that trouble.
Good advice. Hold that thought. We're coming to you. Or matriarchs in motion. This church, I wish this was theoretical. I really do. One queen bee, three viable and aspiring princesses. This is a matriarch and her three daughters-in-law. They're not on the board. They don't have any elective offices. They don't get in the district journal because they don't have an office between them. But they run everything. The matriarch runs everything through her daughters and the daughters' husbands. So runs the church. Just in case this ever happens, how on earth do we deal with the royal family? Should we give up and marry in? You got a son, you got a daughter, you got a niece, you got a nephew. Can you marry in somehow? What should we do with a reigning royal family, ladies and gentlemen? Cue the coronation. Bring the robe, bring the scepter. What? Pastors deal with this all the time, usually by leaving either the church or the ministry or both. Pastors do. Yes? Comment?
I have had experience along this line. Usually I get to know one who is the leader and confirm them, conversations with them, drop ideas, let them develop them themselves, and they bring them and they collect.
Okay. That pertains to church boss also, which is the next topic in here. Very relevant, extremely relevant, exactly what we're talking about. You've got a royal family, they control everything. The DS was going to bring that up, he just forgot. And that drive over to the church, it was on the tip of his tongue, right in there between opportunity and potential. He was going to say, oh, and by the way, there is one family that runs the whole church. Get to know them. Do you work around them? Do you work through them? Do you work in another community? Any wisdom in the room? We're losing pastors to this. I wish it was theoretical, and I wish we weren't losing, but we're losing pastors to this all the time.
Yeah.
Pastors get in, they see how it is, they start working on their resume, they try to stay 2 years because it looks really bad to leave after 18 months, but 2 years you can get away with. That's the ones that stay in ministry. Some of them just bail, don't even stay. Reflect on that. We'll do the church boss question. It's related. Dukes of Hazzard. What would you do if there's a carnal controller that thinks God's church really belongs to him or to her, some well-intentioned dragon? We don't have time. I wish we did. New pastor and wife move into the parsonage. This is like day three, morning three. They haven't even really moved in. He's in his boxers. She's in less. They're both in the kitchen. Parsonage door opens in one motion. There's a knock, open. Guy has the key. He's the church boss. He's come to do some repairs. Pastor's in his boxers. Wife is in less. Wife ducks into the pantry. The boss is ready to work on the... You know, it's 8:15 in the morning. Time to go to work. I'm going to fix some stuff. I'm the hero here. I come to work on the parsonage. You should be thanking me. I wish I was making this up. There's more to the story, but that's in there.
On that door the next day. No, there are lines, and that's one that they just way crossed over. Yeah.
Okay. Again, I wish these were theoretical. Here's a brand new pastor trying to find out how much money the church has in the bank. The treasurer won't tell him. Doesn't want to control the money. Just would like to know, do we have any money? Are we broke? What's our story? Treasurer won't tell him. He goes to the bank, and the bank says, unless your name is... naming the treasurer, unless your name is, I cannot give you the answer to that question. Says no more, goes to the pulpit the next Sunday after preaching, the boss comes up, taps him on the shoulder, understand you went to the bank. Yes. Understand you're trying to find out about financial information about the church. Yes. Verbatim. If you ever try that again, I'm going to have to take you out back behind the woodshed and show you how things are done around here.
It's time to call the cops. They just communicated at front.
Bring it on. Yeah, bring it on. I like how you think. I can't see your name, Pam. Yes, I like how you think.
Knuckles into your back pocket.
That's where you look out. You know, you sometimes, and I know a lot more because I work where I work, but sometimes somebody has to look at that person's eye, because a lot of times a bully is a bully until somebody stands up.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You're honestly telling me that a bank
They won't. No, they won't.
The
yes.
bank called somebody and said your pastor was in here to check on.
Must have. Nobody else hadn't. Nope.
Well, the next thing's going to happen is there's going to be a meeting between me and the bank president. We're going to have a long discussion. And there's going to be a lot of other things happening. Uh-huh. I'm going to bring the manual in with me, and we're going to have a discussion.
Now, because it's a money issue.
All of that.
I would be calling a board meeting, and my DS would be present. And we would be changing who's in charge of the finances, and we'd be having an audit of all the church books immediately.
That should have been done when you took over the church.
Which it might be time to do, it sounds like. Just guessing here, but it might be time to do.
I always get an audit when I take over a new ministry, don't you? I don't want to be
surprised.
What happened to Reverend Blake up there at Detroit First?
Yeah.
Was it $750,000 was missing?
It was only half a million.
Well, I was counting the interest.
Yeah.
But wasn't it? That's what I was close to 2 million, wasn't it? $750,000 is what they got back out of 2 million. Something like that.
So again, don't we wish these were theoreticals? I wish these were theoreticals. Does anybody make a phaser that can be set to inspire sanctification and then just like aimed at people?
Well, would you be sanctified if you pulled the trigger?
I'd let you and God sort that out later, but you can see where my heart is. I am pro-pastor. Since this book came out, all kinds of people want us to write a book called When Bad Pastors Happen to Good Churches. I'm getting that suggestion every day, and I say the same thing every time. Yes, as soon as we find some bad pastors, I'll write that book. See where my heart is? Did I say I was objective? Because I didn't say I was objective. I'm not objective. I love pastors and missionaries. Is there going to be a bad apple? Of course there is. We're all human. Yes. But most of the time, we are better off respecting the people that God has put in place. Let's see where respect takes us. Let's try respect. Let's try it. What are we going to do with the church boss? Seriously, what are we going to do?
I agree with her. A lot of times, the bully's a bully. Mm-hmm. And you don't physically confront them. But following the outlines and the power you're given in the manual, with the DS itself, you deal with the situation. When I took the church I'm in, I found out the treasurer counted the money at his house, and that's where the church computer was, and I made it come back. And
you seem to still be here. You're still breathing in and out. And
you know, it was his his mother, I think, dug the foundation of the original church with the spoon, and she did. But in reality, it was one of the best things that happened because it dethroned him. And in dethroning him, it took a lot of the power away that his family had. I mean, I dealt with it in a loving, redemptive way. I didn't attack anybody, but I found out there was an issue, should have been turned over to the IRS, and made a big mess. But out of this big mess, by being graceful and redemptive, they are some of my best supporters in the church now, whereas before, you know, they would have liked to have found a phaser to do something with me.
Right.
But
you didn't back down.
Well, no, that's it. You know, I had this long conversation with my wife. I had no idea what to do.
Right.
I said, you know, we could be out of here. Right. I had 2 kids at the time. I said, we could be out of here.
Yeah.
We could be out of here in 6 months.
Yeah.
I said, but I have to do what's right just because it's right. Mm-hmm. And whatever the fallout is. And I found out that many other people in the church were glad that somebody, in fact, several years later, a family came up to me and said, do you realize we're 1 month away from leaving the church because it was, and then named this person's church. And it is not anymore.
How long you been there?
About 14 years.
See there? So you didn't back down. You tried to be redemptive, but you did not back down.
I stood up for what was right, and I found out that awful lot of people came around behind me when they realized I wasn't going to back.
Praise God. Yes, Pam.
Well, the whole thing was, he's already answered it. My husband is also a pastor, and we had a situation where we went in like that. And the temptation when things all hit the fan is to leave. Yeah. But you stay long enough that you know, time and truth will vindicate. And you stay long enough that the health of the church, it wasn't much larger when we left than when we went. But the whole health of the church
yes.
was 100%
yes.
better
yes.
than when we left because
yes.
we had, that was one of the issues that
right.
we faced.
Because you didn't back down either,
yeah,
apparently.
And, but
yes.
you didn't run off once you got rid of the treasure. You didn't stir the pot and then leave town, let somebody else come in and clean it up.
Right.
You have to put it back together.
See,
again.
Through
Do I have to stay 14 years?
No.
Okay.
No, but you have to stay long enough. You know, we stayed, it was our second year, and we were there 10 years. So you stay long enough that, you know, the pastor doesn't have to go around patting himself on the back, look what I've done.
Right.
You just keep being truthful and faithful to God.
Right.
God will be the one that puts it all back together for you.
So what are the odds in a room of this size we have two success stories of people facing down church bosses and sticking around to clean up the church, and it works? Mm-hmm. That's cool.
It was respect that was earned because you stood up, and instead of walking away,
got it.
Then
got it.
Many of us lose respect in somebody who walks away from that, but
right.
The respect that was gained,
yes,
the people who were there, and
right.
The respect that was earned in your relationship with
right.
That person, and sometimes we're afraid of our alternatives.
Right.
We face that many times.
So he used his positional authority and then built relational authority by sticking around and being a leader. Is that accurate?
I also never, as much as I wanted to, psychologically, physically take him out to the woodshed, I never did. I always treated him with respect. I always treated his family with respect. I always told him that, you know, this is the right thing to do. I want to be redemptive.
Yes.
And they never left the church. I mean, he was dethroned.
Right.
And he still, at this point, has never been on the board. You know, he won't go back on the board. He won't do anything.
Okay.
But they're engaged in so many other ministries, and they don't try to run things anymore.
Cool. So the church has other leaders in place.
Yes. And
nice.
We've grown from 18 the first Sunday I preached there to where we run 60, 65. So
that's almost a 400% increase.
I know. God's good.
That's cool.
That's the good thing about starting at 18. You've got nowhere to go with it.
Yes. Well.
You get five people, you look so good at
exactly.
District 7.
That's right. See there? See there? Absolutely. And they give you some kind of little plastic thing for that, I think, don't they? I think they do. Some little etched plastic thing. Several questions. Do we want, we, the church, do we want or need some kind of standardized exit interview so that a pastor who is leaving can report about the church, congregational health, leadership issues, potential sources of future conflict, profiles of key lay leaders, other issues? Would it help the next man or woman coming in if the previous pastor had done some of this? Or is it the kiss of death to put any of that in writing? So verbally?
And I don't think it's necessarily fair to the flock. No. I think not only do pastors have the opportunity to have a fresh start, I think sometimes the flock needs to have a brand new clean slate and the opportunity to support their pastor and lead in a brand new way.
Okay. I'm going to keep something like that from ever getting out.
Is it useful to know where the landmines might be buried? That's the question. Should somebody say, you know what, I think there might be a landmine over here. You might not want to step there, or is that, would that condition the new person in ways that the new person shouldn't be conditioned?
I think you have to trust the DS with that information.
Ah.
You know, on the way out, I would certainly tell him, hey, by the way, here's the landmine. Find the right pastor who can navigate that.
It's actually the First Church of Bob, and Bob actually runs it, and
psst,
tell the next pastor, psst. Be kind to Bob.
Yeah. I think there's certain things that are relevant, like the VS should share, but I know the one pastor we went into, everybody talked about, you know, so-and-so, he's the grouch to the church, you can't, blah, blah. He became my husband's best supporter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he never caused a bit of trouble, and it wasn't because David kowtowed to him.
Right.
For one thing, I think he's a strong person, he liked a strong leader. But the whole thing was, had we listened to everything that people told us when we wouldn't even ask him to do anything. He was, and I think different personalities, or sanctified,
yes.
Unsanctified,
yes. Right.
Were with different personalities.
Yes.
Right.
And if there's too much of that stuff, then a lot of things will never change because we don't give them room to change.
Right.
Right.
I believe there are some things that you need to be aware of when you're going into a new church. You don't need to know every ABCD.
I would like to take both of you the next five places we go. Seriously, just so pastors could hear firsthand a success story of standing up, digging in, making a difference. It's like, wow, yes.
I think sometimes what might be a landmine for Jim might not be for me.
Mm-hmm.
And if we start passing on the landmines, we in some ways force the person in the flock into the same position over and over.
Good
and
thought.
Over again.
Good thought.
And so I don't think it's. I actually took over the church he left.
Oh, whatever. Yeah. I didn't warn him about things.
Right.
But as he had questions,
yes,
I would answer them.
Right.
But I didn't bring up anything.
Right. I'm going to skip four things so we can end pretty close to on time. Here are some quick observations. Other than our divine resources like the Holy Spirit and the Word of God, I think our most valuable resources are our human resources, our godly, God-called pastors. I think they're worth protecting, preserving for the good of the ministry. We're losing too many of them that we don't need to lose. I think he's got a valid point that not everybody who's a pastor really ought to be in that role. I think that's a valid point, but I'd like for God to help them sort that out rather than a lot of church bosses. We're losing far too many of our clergy to non-natural causes. They're not aging out, they're stressing out, burning out, in their words, failing out. I think those are preventable losses. I don't think we can afford to lose them. Return on investment, I think we might be wiser to retain ministers rather than having to wait to train new ones. It's John, right?
Yes.
I'm just going to pick on you because I like you. I'm guessing you're a better minister now than you were 20 years ago. Am I off base?
I am, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So,
I think.
Well, that's two of us. That's two of us. When we lose the wisdom and the experience and we start all over from scratch, we just repeat the same mistakes and the same drama all over again. I think holding on to what we've got is just worth doing. We tend to put our resources where our values are, we as people, we as denominations. I think when we start making serious ongoing investments in protecting and retaining our pastors, that will show that we really value them. I think we're a great denomination with a wonderful heritage and a bright future. I do think we can do more to help those who serve us. Yes, Karen.
Just a thought, pastors are people too. And life happens to us.
Yes, it does.
And
yes.
My husband died after 27 years of marriage of cancer while I am serving full-time in the middle of a large church. And God allowed me to grieve in front of
yes,
people.
Publicly. Yes,
publicly.
Yes.
And that was a very difficult process to have to, not only to grieve, but to grieve publicly.
Yes, yes.
There was a woman counselor who just happened to have her office in one of our church rooms every week and ran into me in the women's restroom and said, Karen, how are you doing? And I said, fine, doing good. And she said, no, really. And that began a two-year friendship where I went to grief counseling folks with a licensed psychologist. And sometimes we as pastors think, oh my goodness, we have to have it together all the time. And what will our congregation think if we've got to go get help? It was the best thing God could have ever done for me. And
yes.
It wasn't something I would have sought out.
Yes.
But he literally put the counselor right in my lap and said, she's there. Go talk with her. Maybe she needs a friend. Whatever it took. And it was a wonderful thing. And he also called me to be transparent and let my congregation know
yes.
that yes, God has yes. provided this wonderful resource to yeah. help me through the grief process. And as a result, many of our other people in our congregation also sought out for help for the pain and the difficulties that they were going through.
Yeah.
And we need to tear down that barrier.
Yes, we do.
And let pastors have encourage them to go see folks like you who can help in times of real stress. Sometimes we have kids who self-destruct,
yeah.
even in the pastorate. Sometimes
yeah.
we have marriages that end up in real crisis.
Yes.
And we don't go get help because it's a stigmatized thing. We need to stop that and go get some help.
Yes. Amen to that. I'm going to have this John pray us out in about 60 seconds because I want to respect the boundaries of the time and also because I have to walk across the hall and start a whole new seminar on a whole different topic. So we're going to stop in about 60 seconds. So John, get ready to pray. But just here's some extra credit for you somewhere here. Here it is. Just some food for thought if you are personally in ministry. Develop an identity that supersedes your role. Your identity. It's okay to be a pastor. It's wonderful to be a pastor. God may have created you for that role, but you have to have an identity that supersedes your function or your role. Derive an authority that supersedes your setting. It really is not up to Boss Hogg or the royal family. That's not where your authority comes from. Amen. You do as a Nazarene pastor have a manual. There's some structural political stuff there, but I'm talking about a higher power, really. I'm talking about who you really actually work for. Desire an intimacy with God that saturates your focus. When you are really, really, really tight with God, it's hard for the mosquitoes to get in there and buzz just because you're so tight with God that those little buzzing mosquitoes, they're still there. You're just not as aware of them because you're so tight with God. And then design a family life. Don't get me started here. That's why we're going to quit. Design a family life that sustains, that nourishes you personally, that is a source of sustenance and nourishment. Thank you. God bless.